Hope you guys are doing well tonight. We're going to be talking about the patriarchs. I believe I saw a hand. Did you have a question? Oh, no question? Okay. All right. I thought I saw. Okay, we're very good. Well, we're glad each and every one of you is here, that we're going to be getting underway. And we will go until 7 o'clock. This is our new start time at 6 p.m. for Pastor's Bible Study. If you all are interested, we can modify our setup a bit to put some tables in the back. So if you want to go get your dinner and bring it in, that's always another option as well. But nevertheless, let's and so forth. As we begin, let me open us in prayer, and then we'll get underway. So, Father, thank you for this evening. Thank you that we have a time where we can gather and rejoice in you, that we have a way in which we can come and be a part of your kingdom, and we can continue to grow kingdom disciples here at University Baptist Church. Thank you that we have a great way where we're able to just encourage others, be encouraged. We're able to hear from your word, hear out of your truth, and that we're able to continue to grow in our love for you, our followership of you, and as we become more like Jesus every day, may we be united in your spirit. We are mindful of those who among us have lost loved ones, those who among us are suffering, those who are dealing with rehab, those who have gotten bad news this week, Father, that those all of those, you may encourage them, you may uplift them, that you bring the comforter to be a part of them, that through all these difficult times, they're able to see your son, and that through it all, we can see the gospel be proclaimed. We ask this in your name. Amen. So we are excited to get, this is our second week of our study. As I was mentioning, this biblical background study will dovetail just a bit, more particularly as we get kind of into the later weeks with our trip to Israel. We got a great crew going there. The deadline for that has ended up wrapping up. Of course, if you want to go, we can always make room. But we're going to have a great crew of people, 37 going with us, with myself and Dr. Laufer, and a really good number of people staying over for the extension in Jordan and Petra. We are really looking forward to a great itinerary, and nothing's better than getting baptized in the Jordan River in January. So we're going to look forward to that. There's going to be a lot of hallelujahs, we believe, for a lot of reasons. Just as we get kind of going, I always like giving you guys some goodly resources that we have that I'm going to be using. I'll kind of let you know. I'm going to show you a couple things as we get into it, depending upon the time that we have to do so. I've got some digital resources as well as some book resources. This is the atlas that we have in the back. It is the Holman Atlas. It's one of the ones. I got this atlas, not this exact one. I got the one in my office before I went to seminary in 2001. And the atlas is one of the best ones out there. Great maps, great conversation. One of the things I love about this atlas is it's accessible to everybody. I was going through a biblical backgrounds book that I used many moons ago, and kind of trying to get into their conversation about the patriarchs tonight. And for the first 20 pages of their conversation, it was stuff that doesn't really matter in a significant way to what we were trying to accomplish. So sometimes a lot of scholars can bog down in the weeds and forget they're in the middle of a forest. One of the things that Tom Briscoe does so well in this is that he keeps the forest in view. This is a great atlas. That's one of the reasons we put this one in your guys' hands and said this is one to go with. You're going to grow like crazy if you use it. You can use it for study. You can use it for personal growth, just kind of understanding the context. Another one that I picked up that not too long ago is the Carta Bible Atlas. The Carta Bible Atlas, and this atlas came out, probably about 20, well, came out in 1968, and it's been updated a couple times. This edition's from 2011. This is a very good atlas. Now, if you can find it on Amazon, it has a tendency to go for about 50, 60, 70 bucks. It's a very good one. Doesn't do a lot with the context that we're going to be talking about tonight, which is the patriarchs, but it has some really great stuff about the later stages, particularly the divided kingdom stage, and then getting into Jesus' ministry, locating a lot of the context with it. And it is not in color. It's kind of in green and white. But the one, the Holman Atlas, is in color. And that's always a good thing. And y'all can tell Kyle Wilson that I said that we like to choose books for him with pictures. So we got a good one for everybody. I think it's accessible for what we do, and especially people that we love and give a hard time to. But nevertheless, so tonight we're going to talk about the patriarchs of the Old Testament. This is really what we had anticipated was our third week into the study. It's going to be our second week. And kind of as we usually go along, if you guys see something that pops into your mind, if I can finish my thought, I usually try to get to questions or thoughts. We'll also have a time at the end in case there's anything that I left unanswered. But if you have the copy in the back, I've distributed my notes for this evening. And that you'll notice on the back, I've also included a map or two. I don't know if they're going to be helpful for you. I think they might be for what we're doing. They're a little bit small on the type. They were a lot bigger on my computer monitor, but I had to try to get them both on there. They come from a resource called the Net Bible, which is the New English Translation Bible, which is a really good way to go about getting a good translation. It has some great resources in the back. I can talk to you about the Net Bible a little bit more. On and on. But we're going to pick up with this paper. I pretty much have what's going to be on here is going to be behind me, but then I also have a bunch of maps and a few other things that we want to talk about. The study of biblical backgrounds is a study of the setting and context in which Scripture arises. The study of biblical backgrounds is the study of the context an area or geography in which the context in which Scripture arises. You're going to learn a lot about the kind of the story behind the story, what's going on behind the text, what's going on and around it. As we're going to see tonight, as we dig into the patriarchs, we're going to see that there's a lot of names of places that are mentioned just kind of haphazardly, it seems, or in the text, that there are places that we're familiar with, and they help add context. They help add depth to what we're doing with that. And we'll kind of pick up. The patriarchs of the Old Testament represent several key figures in the history of Israel who laid the foundations of their society and identity. The patriarchs are those people. Now, I've got a little bit of a list there, and they really occupy the span of Genesis from Genesis chapter 12 all the way to, well, really 11:27, Genesis chapter 12 all the way to the end of the book of Genesis. And it's, for the most part, three major figures. And we have it there in our notes, which is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These three primary figures are who represent the patriarchs. Occasionally, somebody, sometimes scholars will do this, sometimes popular writers will do this, they'll add a fourth, who is Joseph. I don't include Joseph as a patriarch of Israel because Joseph is not, I'll use kind of the technical term and then I'll define it, he's not a progenitor of Israel. Israel does not arise from Joseph's line as directly as Israel arises from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Joseph's in the story. Joseph occupies an extremely important part of the story. In many ways, Joseph is a precursor to the story of Christ. But he is not, in my opinion, someone out of which Israel arises. Part of that is because there is no tribe that carries on named after Joseph in a meaningful way out of Israel. That's a very significant point. Reuben has a tribe out of him. He's still not a patriarch. Asher has a tribe named out of him. Still not a patriarch. So we want to be careful about that. One of the really critical things is this father-son dynamic in which the nation primarily arises out of. And you're going to learn a lot about that goes on with it. Abraham, we're all fairly familiar with. Isaac has a little bit of a shorter story in the middle of that, but then Jacob has a significant story that goes along with that. And in between all three, we see, one, a kind of a scandalous picture of people who were kind of, not necessarily swindlers isn't the right word, but they were pragmatists in how they dealt with things. We see that people that had maybe not so clearly developed character that we might consider, that issue of Abraham and Sarai, or Abram and Sarai, when they were in Egypt. Maybe that had to do with Jacob and Esau. Maybe that had to do with Isaac and his dealings that were going on. It's not so clear of a moral distinction there. But yet, through all of that, we still see God's discernment. We still see God's protection. We still see God's provision. We still see God's plan. That's a part of all of those things. And through all three, we really see those things: God's provision, God's protection, and God's plan that comes out of all three of the patriarchs. And that through that, we're able to see some things that happen. And we see as we go in, you start off, I mean, the challenge with Genesis and getting into it is that it is based around, in its first several chapters, kind of content that moves around and through generations very quickly. If you were to take, and we don't necessarily recommend this, if you were to take a literal reading of the first couple chapters, how much time arises from the time that Adam and Eve were removed from the garden to the time of the great flood? Does anybody know? About 2,000 years, 2,000 years. And we think that in the midst of all of that, I mean, there's a lot that happened. But do you know how far that span tracks in the book? Only a couple verses. Because this is kind of the nature of how Genesis is laid out. You know, we get into Genesis chapter 11 and we talk about the Tower of Babylon. We talk about different things that are going on with people begetting this person and begetting that person if you're using the King James Version. That is people fathering this person, fathering this person. There's a significant conversation to go on about whether those are ethnographies, which is the idea that those names represent ethnic groups, fathering ethnic groups, fathering ethnic groups, or if there's a little bit more of a linear progression, that this person actually lived this long and this person actually lived this long. There's a lot of conversation that goes on in the scholarly literature about that. Through all of that, one of the things that you're able to see is, again, those three things: God's protection, God's provision, and God's plan that works through it all. And that's really one of the larger stories that goes behind the book of Genesis, and one of the beautiful things that happens with it. We see a lot that comes out of these patriarchal period that sets the DNA for Israel. And that's one of the things I'm, and not only my continuing education that I'm doing, but a lot of the stuff that I did in my initial course on the sort of doctoral work, is looking at the nature of how organizations come together. What are some of those things that build into organizations that become what we would call DNA, those vital components that kind of transcend the amount of people that go through? Churches have an organizational DNA or an organizational identity that will go across different pastors sometimes. You'll see that. One of the things that in doing group ministry we see is that small groups have a tendency to, as they get started, kind of develop their identity, and they carry that identity through a lot of different teachers or a lot of different directors, and there's some things that go on with that. Nevertheless, the thing that we run into with the patriarchs is that they set the tone for not only the historical trajectory that's going to come for Israel, but also the identity that goes in with them. A lot of their character, a lot of the characteristics that they have go before them and set themselves in a way that happens. We'll keep continuing on. The dates for the patriarchal period often range from about 1264 to 1875 BC. Now, there are about five or six different ways that you can date the book of Genesis. I tend to use a more conservative dating. Some people use a more, what we call a critical dating. And that can, we're going to talk about that next week when we talk about the nature of the Exodus. When did the Exodus happen? Did it happen at this time period, or is it probably better situated in this time period? And there's some conversations that go on. The challenge for us is so much of what we do, we think about when the whatever we call AD or Common Era starts, we kind of just think about it going forward. The challenge with BC or before Common Era is you kind of got to do it backwards because you're coming up and you're backing in. I mean, of course, during that time, they weren't using those distinctions. They had other ways of doing the calendaring system. And I always wonder how many decades it took them to figure out that there are 12 months in a year. January keeps moving, or the snow season keeps moving and all that. You're like, well, this probably isn't right. They had a little bit of a process that they went through. A couple other things that go on with that. So we see that the dating that happens in there It lines itself up because the reality is Israel doesn't arise by itself. It doesn't arise in a vacuum. There are a lot of other things that are going on around the context of Israel. They're going around the context of how Abraham is developed or how Abraham comes out. And one of these is that this really occupies a time called the Middle Bronze Age. The Middle Bronze Age. And that this is a time of development, where there are many geopolitical entities that are in flux and in formation. This is an age from roughly about 2000 BC to about 1550 BC, in which there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of things that are happening around the world. And we know a lot about some of the cultures that are arising, some of the things that are happening, whether that's in what we know as the continent of Africa or Eurasia, including some of the stuff that happens in South America and North America. The challenge that we run into, even in this period, is that you're dealing primarily with nomadic people who don't have a lot of sophisticated systems, so that what they're carrying around with them is a lot of material that is fundamentally organic. So you have trees that they'll carry around with them to create houses. But it's not stone that's going to be used. Stone lasts for a really long time. Trees have a tendency to disperse after a little while or so forth. So it's hard for us to find a lot of ancient sources for what they have, and a lot of ancient sources for what they would have lived in. But we have found a few things about that. In the Middle Bronze Age, we're beginning to see technological advancements, advancements in warfare, advancements in how people live. We see that people are moving from necessarily thatched houses or wooden houses with mud walls to more clay or brick houses. There's a development of technology that begins to happen across this age as well. A couple of the main things that are going on during this time is Egypt is reunified under Mentuhotep II in about 1980 BC. This is a very important part because at one point Egypt had kind of dispersed. There was a bunch of factions that were going on from what is common day Cairo or common day Alexandria. There was a bunch of stuff that was going on. He comes in and unifies a lot of what's going on in Egypt. And there's actually, this is a picture, this is a relief that we have. This is the Shilish rock relief that depicts the king Mentuhotep II in the center of the rock. And you can notice that because he carries with him not only the staff, and let me see if I can pull a couple things up for us here. Let's see what I can do. Pen color, I want to do green. So you see that like in here we have that's the staff that he carries. And if you look at ancient Egyptian reliefs like this that are left around or other depictions, you'll see that often the pharaohs or their leaders, they have a couple key features. One is the headwear or the headgear, as well as a staff that they will carry. And he might have another staff down here in his hand. This represents who he is as a leader. He's the leader of unified Egypt, and he's able to bring them together. As a part of this picture, though, you'll notice that there are four people in total in this relief. The one that stands right here, just off to his left, is his son, Intef III, who is named after Mentuhotep's father, Intef II. And then right next to him is the chief treasurer, which is Keti, that is on the next position over. We actually know that because a couple of the ornate things that go on with that, but then also right here in the picture is his name that's over top of him. We can kind of assume who these other people are, but what's very intriguing about this relief is that in this right here, we see his wife, the queen, Ea, who is pictured off to Mentuhotep's right, which in the relief is, frankly, it's a very significant part of it. So we don't have a lot of physical data from sometimes in this era like we would hope, but we have enough of it to begin to put some of the pieces together. And this is one of those examples. This is going on in Egypt at the time. Now, Egypt becomes a significant player in the story of the patriarchs. because Egypt is ultimately a major regional power. It's ultimately, obviously, we know where Israel ends up at the end of Genesis, because that's where we see Jacob taking his family and all of his tribe and going into there, and that Israel grows in those many years between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, where we see that they're in captivity and so forth. So nevertheless, Egypt is unified in him about 1980 BC. In the Mesopotamian area, we see the Assyrians and the Amorites arise as powers. Throughout Mesopotamia, we see them really coming up. Now, the Amorites are going to be a group of people that are well known in and among Israel, because we see them coming in a lot. But then also we hear about the Assyrians. In this time, they begin developing as a nation state. They begin developing as different states in this area. And you'll also notice in the inset there in your notes that Babylon and Mari are key states by about 1800 BC. Now, Mari is a very important state that you don't hear a lot about, but they're important because they have one of the most significant artifacts from this era that has been retained. And if you've ever been to the Louvre in Paris, you probably have seen this. This is the Stela of Hammurabi that contains the Code of Hammurabi that comes from about 1750 BC. This is one of the most significant archaeological discoveries that was found over the last 100, 150 years or so, because one, it has something that a lot of other pieces of its time don't have. It's intact. The other thing that it has is it's got very clear writing on it, as well as a few other things. I've kind of given you a little bit of a blow up, I think, on the screen there. And one of the things that you can see is you have a depiction in the top here of Hammurabi receiving or giving the law to a scribe, which is a very important picture. But then right down here, and if you go and look it up online, you can see a little bit, because it's really this whole phrase, this whole section right here. And the thing about it is it's fairly large, and it goes all the way around. So the writing goes all the way around, and it just keeps going down and around the stela. This is the code, the law code of Hammurabi, and it begins with a very interesting depiction. What happens is we were always wondering, where did the authors of Genesis get really Genesis 1:1 to 2:3? Where do they get these creation narratives that happen in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2? What was the context in which they got them? Well, there's a lot of alignment as to the creation narrative that happens in Hammurabi's Stela, where you hear about kind of a statement that's similar to what we have in Genesis in terms of what's going on. And I'll read it to you, and it really is in this section right here that's a significant part. It says this: "And when Anu the Sublime, king of Anuakan, and Bel, the lord of heaven and earth, who had decreed the fate of the land, assigned Marduk to rule over the son of Ea, god of righteousness, dominion over earthly man, and made him great among the Ege, and they called Babylon by its illustrious name, and made it great on earth, and founded it on an everlasting kingdom, whose foundations are laid so solidly as those of heaven and earth. Then Anu and Bel called by name me, Hammurabi, the exalted prince who feared God, to bring the rule of righteousness to the land, to destroy the wicked and evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black-headed people of like Shamash, and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind." Now, it goes on for a number of other lines, but one of the things that you see in this is that Hammurabi is laying out what is the basis on which he can deliver law to his people. Well, what's the basis that you heard? Well, gods gave it to me. The gods gave me this basis for being able to decree the law, because they created the world, they created the earth and the heavens, and they created me, and I'm here to give the inspired law. And the law goes on, and it's stuff like this. I'll give you a couple examples. If anyone ensnare another, putting a ban upon him, but he cannot prove it, then he that ensnared the other shall be put to death. Another one is, if anyone brings an accusation of a crime before the elders and does not prove what he has charged, he shall, if it be a capital offense, be put to death. If he satisfy the elders to impose a fine of grain or money, he shall receive that fine and the action that it produces. If anyone steals the property of a temple or a court, he shall be put to death, and also the one who receives the stolen thing shall be put to death. The crime and punishment in this period was a bit more severe than we have, perhaps, in a lot of ways. But these are pretty normal kinds of laws that you see from this period. What comes in very particularly about the Stela of Hammurabi is that it's a very unique picture into the Middle Bronze Age of something that probably would have been depicted in the middle of the capital city, as well as taken around to multiple other towns or cities throughout that kingdom, and that would have been the point at which they began the adjudication of the law. Very important stuff that goes on there. And last little point here before we start getting into the meat of what we're talking about. In Persia, which is an important region for what we're going to be considering not only tonight but also in the future, the consolidation is occurring. Ur, which is Ur of Chaldees, is destroyed in about 2000 BC. Now that's an important date because this is a major kingdom, this is a major city, and it gets destroyed. What becomes intriguing is what happens with Abraham, where he gets called out of Ur of Chaldees prior to its destruction. A very providential thing to have happened. And I don't know if you'll be able to see much off of this, maybe. This kind of gives you the three of the regions that I've been talking about, one of the regions I've been talking about, two of the regions I've been talking about, which is Mesopotamia, Egypt, and Palestine. This is actually, I believe I took this from the Atlas. And if I did, it's going to be on, you can probably look at it there. It's going to be on page, where did I get it from? 41. There we go. Page 41. And you'll see they'll have, this is one of the things that Tommy does really well, is that he's able to lay this kind of this stuff out and give you that larger context that's going on, thinking about the things that are happening around the world of the patriarchs. Because again, just like with Christianity in the first century, in this time, Israel doesn't arise in a vacuum. They don't arise as a bunch of people stuck on a rock that nobody ever comes into contact with. Rather, they arise in the middle of a context, a socio-political or a geopolitical context, in which one's fate is ultimately determined by the powers over top of them or the whim of someone. But this gives you some really good examples of things that are happening, things that are going on in this period, and so forth. So nevertheless, carrying on with that. Couple pieces on the context in which we're talking about here. Right now, in this time period of human development, tribal nomadic living is the norm for many, and it's based in an agrarian economy. Tribal or nomadic living is really the norm for everybody, and it's based in an agrarian economy. It's not surprising because that is the primary way in which kind of economies rise. We were primarily agrarian-based all the way through the beginning part of last century, even as a nation. Look at how we do things in our society still. The way that our school system, our school calendar is structured is based on the agrarian system. The way that we do church every Sunday is based on the agrarian system. We do so much of what we do based on that because its influence is so wide-ranging. Because God did not choose to create people or create society and then give them Macintosh computers to run everything. There's a reason, because of the Apple, but that's for free. See, the jokes get worse as we get into it. But the thing about it is that there's a natural development. God uses natural means to accomplish his providential will. God doesn't take scripture and just drop it out of the sky and plump it in front of people. That's not the way God works that we as Christians understand. We believe that God uses a natural process to bring about the development of his scriptures. And for what it's worth, they wouldn't have looked anything like this in the first two centuries of Christianity. They would have been on parchments, on scrolls. The codice didn't arise, or the books didn't arise like this for a long time. because that's how God chooses to work, it seems. But also during this time, society becomes established after two centuries of decline. Again, the kind of the up and down of society, there are moments where human society could have very well cavitated and just disappeared. And there are times where it looked really bad. Plagues are going on, or extended famines, massive amounts of food insecurity during these times. You genuinely had no idea where your next meal was going to come from if you lived on your own. So that's why you had to clump with other people that were like you, that were like your clan. And you had they weren't very sophisticated, but very plain systems of food discovery and delivery and consumption, because that really is what your entire day was wrapped around. How can we find food, cultivate food, make food, and get food to eat food so we can go get more food, to cultivate food, to make food, to eat food, to get food so we can go get more food? I mean, that's really what your everyday existence is. And that's why it takes a long time to do really the technological stuff that happens. And some organizations, some countries, some cultures do this better than others. And then finally, before we get into Abraham, the patriarch stories frame much of the historical tales. It should be historical tales, T-A-L-E-S, of Israel. This is autocorrect at its finest. But they also present a different kind of deity. Again, so notice this, that as we get into Genesis, we immediately encounter God the Father. We immediately encounter Yahweh. We immediately encounter the God of the Old Testament, functionally different, personally different than all the other deities. This is, and if anything we learn from the first creation account in Genesis, one of the reasons that it's existing the way that it exists is that God is the God over everything. Everything that you and I can imagine. He's not a demigod that's only over speaker systems and church sound systems. He's not only a demigod who's over the AC system in our church. No, this is the God who's the God over everything. He started everything, he begins everything, and in him is everything. This is a different view of God. But even more so, this God who created everything, is in everything, is about everything, created everything, is over everything, is personal. Because he comes and reveals himself to individuals. And one of the first people is Abraham, or a man named Abram. And we're going to look at that here in a moment. But ultimately, this is a God who is different from Israel, from the other deities, and it really becomes personal and accessible. And what becomes intriguing is the ever-broadening covenants that we go through in the Old Testament really allow themselves to be seen as the God who isn't just the God of this clan, but is the God of all clans. There's something that's really amazing that happens there in Scripture. A couple other things that I've got for you here, another map that I think might help. If you can see it. This is actually, again, this is out of the Atlas, the Holman Atlas that we've distributed. You'll see a couple of the significant geopolitical powers that are going on in this era. You'll notice, and let me see if I can get a different color here, because I'm going to need a different one. You'll notice a couple things. Obviously, we're very familiar with over here. That's Egypt. Up in here is Canaan. Over here, we see Assyria that's developing. This is the kingdom of Mari. We're getting into the Persian region up and around and through here. Ur of Chaldees, which is a very significant point, is right down here. What is southern Iraq today? We'll see that. You'll notice the major rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates River, which are visible in here. Up into here is the land of the Hittites. You'll notice, again, kind of the things still look all the same because of the nature of how these things go. We'll see a couple other major things that happen. You look in your atlas, you'll be able to see a little bit more. Again, because Israel arises in a context. It doesn't arise in a vacuum. But who is this guy Abraham? So who's Father Abraham? What are some things you guys know about Abraham? Give me a couple things. What are a couple things you know about Abraham? What's that? He was a Mesopotamian. Yes, absolutely. He grew up in that region. What else? He didn't have kids for a very long time, but he's also known as what? The father with many sons. Corey goes into the Abrahamic covenant. I keep using the word progeny, but your descendants will be as numerous as the stars. Now, when you look outside tonight and you look up in the sky, you're going to see some stars. But you're not going to see as many stars as Abraham could have seen back in his day. Why is that? Yeah, light pollution. We live near the third largest metro area in the United States, or fourth largest metro area in the United States. I think it's the third now. There's a lot of light that comes out from that. But then we also have some other kinds of, a little bit of pollution. I was out in Big Bend probably about 5 months ago. And one of the nights that I was out there, I woke up in the middle of the night because a rock had found the middle of my back under my tent. And it woke me up because it was pointing. And I was like, well, it's 3 a.m., so let me look outside and see what's going on. I walked outside from my tent, and I looked straight up, and you could see everything. You could see millions upon millions of stars. You could see stuff that is unbelievable. You could track the space station as it was going through the orbit. Also helped that I had my phone so I could pull up one of the, because I'm not good at this stuff at all. I don't look up and see a bull. I don't look up and see all this Scorpio and all this other stuff. But it helps when you have the little pictures. But I was able to see everything. And for Abraham to be able to look up into the sky at night, knowing that he was very old in his age, but yet God told him he was going to have as many descendants as our stars in the sky, is an amazing thing to think about. And that God ultimately sees through that provision and that protection and that plan. It's an amazing thing. What else do we know about Abraham? What are some fun parts of his story? Who was the firstborn for Abraham? Ishmael. And who is Ishmael known as the father of? Islam. Yeah. Isaac is known as the father, one of the fathers of Israel. Abraham's story isn't as clean as a lot of people would think that it would be, because then you have the whole taking his wife into Egypt and letting her go live with the Pharaoh for a couple years because it was a good business deal. But then there's some other messier parts. But there's also some amazing faithful parts. The question to sacrifice his son, Isaac. Amazing statement of faith of Abraham. Where did we begin his name? What was his name originally known as? Abram. Yeah, it was Abram, and then he gets it changed by God to Abraham. His story picks up there in Genesis chapter 11, verse 31, and Terah, let me go to 27. These are the family records of Terah. Terah fathered Abraham, Nahor, Haran, and Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in his native land in Ur of Chaldees during his father Terah's lifetime. Abram and Nahor took wives. Abram's wife was named Sarai. Nahor's wife was named Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, father of both Milcah and Ishka. Sarai was unable to conceive, and she did not have a child. In verse 31, Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, Haran's son, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they set out together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. And Terah lived 205 years and died in Haran. And that begins the story of Abram there in the 11th chapter of Genesis. So he begins his life in Ur of Chaldeans. This is a city that he would have lived in. He was the son of Terah, uncle to Lot. Abram appears to be a wealthy herdsman of his day. As wealthy as a herdman can do. There's some generational claim behind here. And he is ultimately called by God to migrate to Canaan in the middle of this. We'll see this in chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. And the Lord said to Abram, go out from your land, your relatives, and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse anyone who treats you with contempt, and all the peoples on the earth will be blessed by you. So Abram went, and as the Lord had told him, and Lot went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran, and he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. And when they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land on the site of Shechem and at the oak of Moreh. And at that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And the Lord, this is verse 7, appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give you this land. So he built an altar there for the Lord who had appeared there for him. And from there he moved into the hill country east of Bethel and pitched his tent. And with Bethel on the west of Ai to the east, he built an altar to the Lord there and called on the name of the Lord. And when Abram journeyed to the stages of the Negev, we see that this is the beginning of Abram's entrance into Canaan and that God promises him this land. Soon after arriving, a famine occurs and then forces them to Egypt. So Abram goes into Egypt. And if you actually look real quick, the map that I have on the back, it's the tinier of the two, unfortunately. The map that I have on the back is this map here, and this traces the route of Abram, kind of where he was going. There are some thoughts that larger circle on the top of the map, or kind of in just a little bit higher than the center of the map, that is a possible alternative site of Ur of Chaldees. Most scholars put Ur of Chaldees right there at really the delta of Iraq, near what is now the Persian Gulf in the area of Sumer. But then you kind of see the destination of it, of Abram and where he was traveling and what he was doing. And we'll go from there. This is from the Atlas. This is kind of discussing the migration of Abram. The main line, the heavy line, is his migration route. The dotted line that you see that kind of runs from here, that's kind of a possible alternate route. Again, these are nomadic people. They have camels with them, perhaps. They have donkeys. They have, or maybe donkeys. They have sheep. They have some animals with them. They don't carry houses around with them. They don't carry fortifications. They have tents that they live in. So wherever they travel, they kind of go in that. As soon as they leave, within not too long, they go away. I was outside of Dubai a couple of months ago, and I was on a desert safari, and it was interesting. They kind of gave us a little bit of a resting point, and we all got out of the cars. It was ultimately, I think, because the cars needed to rest, because, you know, it was only about 120 degrees, and we've been running around like crazy. And it was interesting, as I walked out into the middle of this desert space, I'd leave footprints behind me. And then within a few moments of just general wind, my footprints were already gone. It's kind of the nature of how life is, that within a few generations, we're all gone, except for some extraordinary people. But that also that how quickly things can go away in history, it's kind of a testimony to that. Picking up with Abraham, Abraham's story is ultimately laid over the changing times of Palestine. It's ultimately laid over the changing times of the region that we call Palestine. Now, when I talk about Palestine, I'm not talking about the political entity that is Palestine today. I'm talking about the broader region of Palestine. I'm talking about that area that has been there forever. It's a little bit more of a technical way to refer to it. But in this time, there's a lot of change that's going on. There's a lot of significant changes that are happening. And Abraham's story happens among those things. And you see some of these things that pick up about the things that happen, where they are and what goes on. And we see a little bit more of it develop in Isaac's story. We see a lot of it develop in Jacob's story as well. But you begin hearing about things like in Genesis 13, 18. So Abram moved his tent and went to live near the oaks of Mamre in Hebron, where he built an altar to the Lord. You'll see these things that kind of come up, things that would have perhaps been familiar with the readers in the days in which Genesis was authored, but aren't necessarily familiar with us, because a lot of these places don't exist anymore. One of the more significant places that exists in Abraham's story is the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And why don't they exist anymore? Because of why? They were wiped out. They got wiped out by who? By God. That's true. And that kind of thing happens occasionally. And you see that. So there's a lot of reasons why it's hard for us to locate with a lot of certainty some of these major things. because it's hard to find these things. Ultimately, the covenant of Abraham happens in Genesis 15, but then there's also a second part of it in Genesis 17, is a central point of history. It's a central point of the history of Israel. It's a central point of the history of the world. Now, why does it matter to the history of the world that Abraham was blessed by God in a very specific way? Because there's a group of people that believe that Abraham's blessing meant that they have a land that is theirs forever. But then there's also another group of people that believe, because they were descendants of Abraham, that they have the land forever. And then there's Christians who want to just take the land, and because that's where Jesus was. And it's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of things that go on with that. Even today, we're struggling with that. I guarantee you can pick up a newspaper tomorrow, or you can go to some news source, and there's probably some conflict going on in Israel related to the Abrahamic covenant at some level. I think currently we have a group of people from the current administration that are over there trying to broker a peace plan between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They've been doing this for a long time. It goes back to the Abrahamic covenant. And then ultimately the conflict over Isaac and Ishmael is also a turning point in history. There's not a lot of work that's been done on Ishmael in a significant way, but there are a couple ones that have come out recently, and they're very good treatments. Ultimately, the question is, what do you do with Hagar and Ishmael? Where do they factor into the whole thing? Are they really the people who led ultimately Islam rising up, or for Muslims rising up? How do we understand that? Are they just adopted by people in history? Those are good questions to ask. And that's kind of the story of Abraham. Top through real quick so we have a little bit of time for questions. And then we move over. This is on the back of your paper. Isaac. Isaac is the son of Abraham. He's the inheritor of the covenant. Isaac is born to Abraham and Sarah at a late stage of their lives. What's intriguing about him is he's the only patriarch of the three who doesn't leave his land. He just kind of stays there. Isaac's story is a bit shorter than Abraham's, and it's a bit shorter than Jacob's. It's kind of in the middle. He finds an Aramean wife named Rebecca and takes her in. What's intriguing is that Abraham told Isaac not to take a Canaanite wife because Abraham thought that the Canaanites were wicked, but rather go and find a wife of another clan like the Arameans. And they go and find one of the Arameans, and there's something significant about that that goes on. And there's some conflicts that are going on. You see those ethnic conflicts that happen. He ends up having two sons, Esau and Jacob, who are fraternal twins. Now, what do you know about the birth of Esau and Jacob? Esau's born first. That's true. And what is Jacob doing when Esau is born? He's holding on to his heel. Yeah. That would have been surprising. Can't imagine if that happened today. Might make the news. I don't know. So there's already conflict that's laden into their story. That when the two are born, and what was it said? It's interesting when you read that, the account of them, because it said that when they were with their mother was pregnant with them, they were doing what? They were in conflict all the time. I can't even imagine what that's like. But they were in conflict as she was pregnant with them while they were in utero. It was an amazing thing to think about, that conflict ultimately works itself out in their lives. Because we see that with Esau and Jacob, we have two major events that occur. The first one is what? It's where Esau sells his birthright to Jacob. And this is always good, because this is a good sermon. Don't sell your birthright for a mess of pottage. That's the way that the King James deals with it. I think it's always better. So basically what it is don't sell your birthright for a cup of lentil soup. Don't sell the most important thing that you have in your life for a measly bowl of soup because you're hungry. No, there's significant things that God calls us to. Your character takes years to build, but a moment to go away. It's a significant thing that we learn from that. But then what's the second conflict that they had? The blessing. Yeah. So Isaac is going to give his blessing to the firstborn son. And just because the firstborn son happened to be born 3 seconds earlier than the secondborn son, Esau is going to inherit the significance of what Isaac has. But no, Jacob goes in at his mom's encouragement. And I have no clue how you can be this hard to see. But I guess as you get older, this kind of things might actually be possible. He puts on, goat skins on his arms and dresses himself up and tries to make himself smell like his brother, which I guess means he didn't take a bath for a couple years, those kinds of things. And he takes the inheritance away from his brother, which immediately causes conflict. So what happens? Jacob has to flee because his brother is going to kill him, because there's one way to get an inheritance back. That's at the end of a knife. When it's in somebody's gullet, that's an easy way to get, because there's no police. Who's going to bring the sheriff out to go get these people? But ultimately, we see in this story, we see many nations and regions mentioned. There's so much going on, and you read through this about what's happening and where they go and who they talk to. People that are laden in there. One of the things that you see right there, let me find a good one. That's in there. Here, Esau's anger in Genesis 27:42. And when the words of her older son Esau were reported to Becca, she summoned her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Listen, your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning on killing you," which is a great thought. So now, listen, my son, flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him for a few days until your brother's anger subsides, until your brother's rage turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him, and then I will send for you. So immediately she brings in somebody who had happened in a place that had happened earlier in the story in the Abrahamic discussion. So again, we have these layers that begin happening, all this stuff that's happening with where Haran might be. And then we get to, this is ultimately Jacob, the father Isaac, grew up around Beersheba. Beersheba is, let me give you this real quick. This is their quest. Beersheba is all the way right down here. Ooh, that's kind of really a big circle. But it's right down here. This is where Beersheba is, right here. There's a couple other Hebrons like right here. This is where Gaza is today. You see the Dead Sea. You see the Sea of Galilee. Jerusalem doesn't exist yet, but Jericho is mentioned right here. That's going to be an important name as well. Kind of keeping giving you the geography of where everything is. But going back to our discussion here. Younger brother to Esau, relationship is in conflict at birth. While fleeing Esau, he returns to Padan Haram to find a wife. Padan Haran, we'll go over here. And I'll show you this real quick. Padan Haran is located, actually it's right here, this region right there. I think I did that good enough. You're way up on what is Syria, that border between Turkey and Syria, which is a place you don't want to be today right now, maybe even in northwestern Iraq, depending upon how that works itself out. Jacob ultimately has 12 sons from 4 women. He had took 2 wives. What's the story about his wives? What happened to him? He got tricked. Yeah. He went for one wife, and then he ends up getting he gets tricked by her dad, and then ultimately has to wait around. You can't blame that on old age. You can blame that on a schemy dad. But then what's interesting is that the 2 sisters who he's married to both have 2 chambermaids that Jacob fathers these 12 sons from the 4 different women. They ultimately form, and we want to be careful about this and how I say this. I've made it pretty simple here, but there's something a little bit longer. They form the type of the 12 tribes of Israel is probably a better way to say this. The challenge with the 12 tribes of Israel is multifaceted. One is that there are different tribal lists moving forward. And I can break into that as we get into that a little bit. There's something that happens. The other challenge is by the time we get to the end of the Old Testament, what tribes exist? really only one and a half is what we're going to call them, one and a half. It ultimately is Judah. Absolutely, you're right if you said Judah. But Benjamin got absorbed into Judah, so it's all the kids that are left-handed, become Judahites, which ultimately become Jewish. What happens to the other 10 tribes is they kind of get absorbed into the many different cultures because they have bad rulers, they intermarry, they disperse. And there's a lot of mess that comes at the end of the Old Testament that happens right here in 2 Chronicles and so forth. Ultimately, Jacob returns to Canaan and has to confront Esau. And that Jacob story ends in Egypt as he takes all of Israel to a new land. As a part of that, now in between these, you have the story of Joseph that arises, where Joseph and the Technicolor dream coat comes from a coat of many colors, goes through the slavery. We see him get taken in, and he goes into the court of Pharaoh, becomes a significant person through a lot of different stuff. Potiphar's wife's in there, that whole story. And ultimately redeems the situation by showing grace to people who have treated him gracelessly. That's always kind of the catch, isn't it? Can you be a person of grace to people who are graceless towards you? It's a very significant thing. This is kind of a map, as I kind of mentioned with you guys before. I kind of showed you a couple of the key things. That's that larger map that's on the back there. If you use a magnifying glass, maybe you can see what's going on with that. Yeah, and so forth. So again, just wrapping it up, the ongoing events around them deeply inform the patriarch's setting and context, from conflict among nomadic herdsmen to pharaohs in Egypt. And really, that's really the spectrum, isn't it? These nomadic herdsmen that are over here, that are tending their flocks, they have no access to wealth, they have no access to power, they have no access to anything except being shepherds and herdsmen, all the way to Pharaoh's court, the most significant part of the empire, the most significant part of what they have, that we see that their stories are in many ways products of their times and lands. And anyways, so next week we're going to talk about Egypt and the Exodus. And I just wanted to see if anybody had any thoughts or questions for us as we're wrapping up. Yeah.
I think the interesting thing about the Code of Hammurabi, one of them, is that the theme that the strong should protect the weak.
Yeah.
That was pretty surprising during that time period.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There's some things that arise out of some of those earlier laws just like that that catch us by surprise. The strong protecting the weak is one of those, because you don't really suspect that, because there's so often we see from this period, it's not that power under people, but it's really that power over people, those concepts that work. There is that protection that's built in there, because we recognize that the citizens, it's easier to call together citizens for great things who you've been protecting, which really begins setting the tone for that, and does carry through a lot to what even we do today. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
Is there any relationship with the problems in Israel today, the election in the Likud, which is, I think, something like our Congress, and split, and so Netanyahu has the same number of votes as his opponent? Does that go back to the old days? How do they platform?
Yeah, so the question is, for instance, the current election challenge for Netanyahu and Israel parallel things that are going on in the Old Testament? That depends on who you ask. Some folks would say, absolutely it does. Other folks would say, nah, not so much. I think that there's a lot of patterns that emerge. I think that one of the challenges that you run into is that a lot of the concepts, a lot of the key things that happen in this book are the nature of how people are. I think we need to be very careful about people that say that we need to look to modern day Israel for all of our end times discussions that go on. I think you have to be careful. My position's a little bit different than our senior pastor here, so I can get away with saying this. We'll find out tomorrow. I think you need to separate political Israel from spiritual Israel. So I think that you need to be very careful with the modern political state of Israel and making sure that we don't interpose the spiritual Israel of the Old Testament into the modern day, because there's so much difference. And if I could get a giant whiteboard and walk you through what happened at the end of 2 Chronicles to 1947 to 2000 to 2019, I think I can make a pretty good case that there are significant distinctions. Now, this is not to say that the things that go on at the end of the book in Revelation and then also throughout the New Testament don't have application to the modern day state of Israel. I think we just need to understand them in their context. So we'll find out how that goes. That's a good question, Todd. So I would say that I think the patterns of history inform what we are today. And I think that we can see some of those patterns. I don't know what's really going to happen in the Knesset with all of this stuff. But it's interesting to see how bad some of the rulers were, how good some of the rulers were, and how God's providence worked in all of that. So that's kind of, I think, does that answer your question? Okay, there we go. Okay. What else? Yeah.
To help me with the time element, I assume that the Hebrew calendar is used at this time.
The Hebrew calendar?
And is there a year of one?
Can I do this? Can I answer your question about the calendar next Wednesday night? I would like to do that because I want to get you the exact answer. And if I guessed, I probably would guess wrong. Our pastor would know because he's an Old Testament guy. I would guess wrong probably. I would suspect there are multiple calendars being used in the different regions. I don't think that the Hebrew calendar was at play yet, but I could be wrong about that. So let me get you some information and I'll get you an answer. Ask me next week. And I'll put it in my thinker to get you a good answer. That's okay. All right. Yes. Ooh, so the authorship date of Hammurabi's code versus the authorship date of the Pentateuch. So the Pentateuch probably was written after the Exodus. The Exodus doesn't happen for another 500 years. The development of it. Yes. I would. Yeah. Yeah. So I would suggest that the Stela of Hammurabi existed prior to the development of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Pentateuch. I think this is because I've done enough work to be really dangerous on this. But I think that the first creation account of Genesis, Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, that's the first creation account. And when I say first creation account, I'm not suggesting that there are two creation events. I'm suggesting there are two creation narratives that are different in focus. And there's a reason for that. We can mess around with that later on. I see so much of Marduk from Hammurabi that I just read. I see so much of the other, what's the better word than pagan? I'll just use pagan. A pagan mythology from around this time that Genesis, the first account, exists to correct. Because again, notice, this isn't the God of the stars. This isn't the God of the earth. This isn't the God of the waters. This isn't the God of the clouds. This isn't the God of the crops. This is God who does all things. And out of ex nihilo creation, this is the tohu vabohu of creation, which arises all of things that come out of it. This God, the God of Israel, goes far beyond all of these other gods. This is the purpose of that first, one of the purposes, there's a couple, of that first creation account. It seems to me they knew about those other accounts. And while they don't list them directly, that they're right behind the text. They're right behind the text. because the text is answering those other cosmologies, that is, those other pagan creation accounts, with its point-by-point refutation. This God, the God of Israel, is the God of all creation, not a God who's contingent on us, but rather we're contingent on them. That, I think, is the purpose of those accounts. I think they knew about it. So it depends on who you think wrote Genesis. I assert, and we can talk about this next week, I assert Mosaic primacy in the authorship of Genesis, particularly in the oral tradition that arises, that it was Moses' story that ultimately gets written down. It seems to me they know about Hammurabi. It seems to me they know about the Enuma Elish. It seems to me that they know about any of these other Egyptian creation accounts of, I'm going to forget all their names, but they seem to know about them. And you see it right there behind the text. And that's not my area of specialization. I've got some friends that do that stuff, and they're really good at it. But I think that it's there. It's a really good question, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is that argument that, you know, this all existed and they just adopted it and absorbed it and all that. I just think there's so much innovation in the account that it stands as an answer. That first account, 1:1-2:3, is an apologetic for the sovereign God of Israel. And then 2:4-2:26 is the creative God of Israel. Why did he put Adam and Eve in the garden? And the focus is on God until you get to chapter 3, and that's when everything gets messed up. I can go on for a little while and then offer an invitation if you need me to. But no, that's really, yeah, it's good. What else? Any other thoughts? Any other questions? All right. Well, if I'm still around next week, I'll see you guys when we get here next Wednesday. Have a great rest of the night. God bless you. Be well.